Hi, listeners and people who are tuning into the YouTube channel. Thank you so much for joining us today. We always appreciate your time, and we are thrilled to have with us a returning guest. Her name is Hannah Smith. If you're a longtime listener, we go way back with Hannah on episode 49, where we talked about benchmarking campaign results. Fascinating episode from that conversation. So be sure to check it out. We'll link to it in the show notes. Hannah, for those who weren't around back in the day when we've talked to her before or aren't aware of Hannah's greatness, she is an award-winning creative consultant and founder of Wordarist.com. Welcome to the show, Hannah, again.
Thank you. And thanks so much for having me back. It's really lovely to be here with you both.
Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, we are going to talk about another fascinating topic that it's a theory that you've been thinking about for quite some time. You've published a post on this as well, and we'll link to that in the show notes too. But just to give a brief overview, because we're going to let you get into the weeds on this, it's a discussion on asset lists versus hero or content-led digital PR. You have a strong opinion on a trend that you're seeing when it comes to these two strategies. Before we go any further, can you explain to our listeners how you define these two terms, Hannah?
Yeah, and I think it's really important that we do define these terms from the outset, otherwise things are going to get totally confusing. So these are my like working definitions, right? So we have asset-less digital PR, and that's when only a press release or a PR pitch email is created. There's absolutely nothing live on the client site that a journalist could link to. Now, often, but not always, this is reactive digital PR activity, but sometimes, you know, it might look slightly different. Often what we're talking about is reactive digital PR, though. Then, on the other hand, we have hero or content-led digital PR. And the way that I think about this is really, this is digital PR where something is created that a journalist could link to on the client site. This could be anything from a blog post to perhaps something people consider a hero piece, as in like a fully interactive piece or something like that, something a bit more expensive. But it doesn't necessarily need to be, which is why I'm kind of speaking about asset-less versus hero or content-led digital PR. So that's how I define the two.
Right.
Makes sense.
A quick question that I had when I was looking at the article that you wrote is if you think that it has anything to do with the uptick in SEO agencies offering reactive PR as a strategy?
Yeah, and I think possibly it is. But I also think it might be coming from the other side. So I think it might actually be demand-led. So in my work, I consult with various agencies. And many people there have kind of told me they're continuing to see an increased appetite for asset-less or reactive digital PR activity and a corresponding decreased appetite for hero or content-led digital PR. So I'm not quite sure where like in which direction this is coming from. But it could be either or both, right? You know, people want it because they're seeing it. Or actually more people are offering it because more clients are asking for it.
Interesting. Do you think cost has anything to do with this, perhaps?
Absolutely.
Like maybe reactive being a little cheaper? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
That makes sense.
Absolutely. I think that, the current economic climate, which is probably not something we want to get into right now, is playing a huge part. I think that definitely companies are under increased pressure to justify spend and justify return on investment. And yes, I do think that that's definitely a core factor.
Dang. Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. So in your article, you have a metaphor that you use called building a moat.
Yeah.
And we would love for you to jump into that part of the article and explain more of your thinking there,
yeah,
if that's okay.
Sure. So if I may, I'll skip backward and then skip forward to that, if that's cool. So I think part of the reason that there's an increased appetite for asset-less digital PR is to do with the way people perceive the pros and cons of the various types of activity. So I think it's often the case, for some people at least, that part of the reason they're more keen to do asset-less or reactive digital PR is they think it's quick to execute, results are quick, and it's comparatively cheap. Whereas content-led or hero digital PR is slow to execute, slow results, and it's expensive, right? And I think that that's kind of, for some people, like all they're seeing. They think like that's the whole picture. And if that's what you, if for you that is the whole picture, I can kind of understand why you think asset-less or reactive is a better bet. But obviously last time I was on, I did, you mentioned, Britt, I spoke about the benchmarking exercise I did, where I looked at 2,000 digital PR pieces from 11 agencies and in-house teams. And in that analysis, I found that asset-less pieces seem to fail at a much higher rate. So 31% of asset-less pieces generated no coverage at all, whereas just 5% of the content-led or hero campaigns generated no pieces of coverage at all. So, and in a similar vein, asset-less pieces are seemingly less likely to generate a large number of pieces of link coverage. So just 1% of asset-less pieces generated 100 or more pieces of link coverage, whereas 8% of hero or content-led pieces generated 100 or more pieces of link coverage. So I think there's perhaps the performance thing isn't really being considered. So sort of from my perspective, I think on the one hand, you have asset-less digital PR fails at a higher rate, but yes, I would acknowledge quick to execute, quick results, and cheap. Content-led or hero, lower failure rate, but slow to execute, slow results, and comparatively expensive. And I think this balances the scales a little bit. But again, I would acknowledge that asset-less or reactive digital PR could still be more effective, right? So dollar for dollar, you're able to generate more linked coverage. That could still be true. And I think it's at that point that I kind of get into the building a moat metaphor, which is a bit of a weird one, but I'm kind of hoping that you'll indulge me with it. So originally when I started thinking about why this was, you know, like why there was such an appetite for reactive digital PR, or that's what I felt I was seeing such an increased appetite, I kind of wondered if it was just like a strategy problem, essentially. Like, are we skipping the strategy? And originally I sort of wanted to talk about it in those terms. But I think the trouble is people get bogged down in arguments between like what is strategy and what is tactics. And I kind of felt like probably wasn't helpful to talk about it in those terms. So instead, what I'm leaning on is, it is quite a horrible metaphor. Building a moat is a business concept. And the original term was actually economic moat. And it was popularized by Warren Buffett. And an economic moat, what it means is it refers to a business's ability to maintain competitive advantage in order to protect its long-term profits and market share. So just like a medieval castle, the moat serves to protect those inside the fortress and their riches from outsiders. So this is gruesome, like as concepts go, horrible, right? I don't understand why all marketing and business concepts have to be quite so about war, but they tend to be, right? They tend to be.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, this might, I was like, I hate this concept, honestly, but it made me think, oh, this might actually be like an interesting way to think about this. Because I then started thinking, well, okay, what does building a moat look like from a digital PR perspective? Mm. And essentially kind of what I arrived at was, you know, I kind of like to think of it in terms of the extent to which we're building defendable assets. And kind of for me, the key issue with asset-less or reactive digital PR is that from a moat building perspective, we're not creating any assets. So that means we're missing out on a load of stuff, right? So we don't have the opportunity for the content we create to rank and or accrue linked coverage over time, right? There's no asset, so there's absolutely no chance that that will happen. We also can't use the content in other ways for other types of marketing, like remarketing or retargeting or any other kind of marketing activity. Again, because there's no asset. So we can't kind of make different uses of the content we're creating. And really, that led me to my core point. I feel like I'm a particular fan of updatable, content-led or hero, however we want to term it, digital PR. Because like over time, these are pieces that you can become known for. Like they actually kind of, they increase in value over time, essentially. These are things which people inextricably associate with your company and therefore do not associate with other companies. So this is hard to explain in the abstract. So it's probably easier just to talk about like some examples, right? And the one that springs to mind straight away is the Michelin Guide, which is like my favorite example of like an idea which I still don't quite understand, honestly, how they managed to get it through. This is a tire company.
Right.
And they're like, we make tires. I know what we will do is we will go around and review all these restaurants and award the best ones a prestigious star rating. And I still love the idea of like, what was going on in that meeting? Like, did nobody
it's
go?
It's wild.
Did nobody go? Like, yeah, but dude, we sell tires. Like, do we have credibility or authority in this area? Now we forget about it. Like, now we're like, oh yeah, Michelin restaurant, Michelin star restaurant. Yes, please. Thank you very much. Except we can't afford it, or I can't afford them. But you know, lovely treat right, when you can, yeah. Right? But yeah, like obviously, other restaurant guides are out there. Other star rating systems are out there. For restaurants, but the Michelin Guide is Michelin's, right? It is theirs.
Yep.
Obviously, that's a pretty big budget, right?
Yeah, a little bit.
An easier one, maybe, to get your head around is the Forbes Rich List. Obviously,
that's a great one. Yep.
That's a list which Forbes have been creating, I think, since 1982, and it's something that they are known for. Sure, there are other rich lists. Like, they are not the only rich list, just like Michelin are not the only restaurant guide. But it's something that's very much theirs and that people associate now with Forbes. And I think that we can start to think about these things, even if we're thinking about them in slightly smaller ways. So kind of my more reasonable budget option, an example which I often point to, is Hopper's Instagram rich list. And so Hopper are a social media tool, and they created their Instagram rich list. I can't remember when they started doing it, a few years ago. But now I think it is something that people are like, oh, no, that's Hopper's, like that's theirs. It's very much in line with what they do. And it's something which I would think they arguably own. Other examples include like Stack Overflow do an amazing developer survey every year. And again, I think because they've done it over time, if you are in that niche, it is something which is, you know, very respected. And also, again, it's like it's theirs. Sure, other people can do developer surveys, but theirs is theirs. So there are a bunch of examples like that. Now, of course, not all hero or content-led digital PR looks like this, but when it does, as I say, I think we're getting into a really interesting place, because whilst most assetless digital PR is kind of easy for competitors to replicate because it's not something that kind of anyone owns. Do you know what I mean? Like there's no asset, there's kind of no proof of ownership. I think content-led digital PR starts getting really interesting because it's kind of we start getting to a place where this is kind of tougher for competitors to replicate because we've started to build something that journalists, hopefully, associate with us. So for me, this is really, like, I guess, like the core of the thing. when I think about, you know, like, what are the pros and cons of React to digital PR versus content-led PR, I think where it gets really powerful is when we start thinking about this idea of like building a moat, building defensible assets. Does that make sense? I feel like I just spoke for about a year.
No, it makes a lot of sense. I can speak personally on, well, actually, while you were talking about our theory, your theories on why this is a thing, I started reflecting on my own experience going from an agency to freelance. And Jackie, I see you shaking your head, so you might agree or resonate with this, but maybe, and that's become a trend in the last year. This isn't a study that I've actually done, but I've noticed a lot more folks, especially in the UK, actually, going from agency to freelance PR, and all of that has to do, I'm sure, with like layoffs that are happening and budgets being cut and people, you know, thinking I should try this to do this on my own. And then when you go and do this on your own, you don't have the resources that you had at your agency. When I went out on my own, I was, I couldn't get past, the fear of not having someone to work on with ideation and come up with these content pieces. I'm not a data journalist, and I know I can't rely on the same person to be there for me for all of the projects that I work on, who might also be freelancing, for example. And yeah, that was a huge block for me. But what worked was coming up with those reactive PR ideas. And that transitioned into me having more confidence and helping my clients do more content-led PR. And that was just being scrappier. But I can't tell you the last time that I've actually promoted something that was as expensive as the content that we've created in the past at the agency we worked at before together, Hannah. So I do think we're like evolving in that regard, but that's just a theory that also kind of came to my mind as you were talking about your own theories on this. I'm just throwing that out there too.
I would definitely agree. And I do think that, you know, there's an argument that says, you know, like some of that was kind of appetite driven too. And certainly it was appetite driven, I guess, like even when I was at Verve, you know, like there were clients who would say to us kind of like, can't you do something a little lower budget? But equally, we did have some clients who wanted to do very ambitious, very expensive projects. Like the obvious one for me that springs to mind, we did a piece called 24-Hour London when I was at Verve, which was, we did the world's first gigapixel time lapse of the London skyline. And we did it in partnership with Nikon. And, you know, like this was a huge project with a bunch of moving parts, right? Like we needed Nikon for their, you know, photography expertise. This was not us just like going to a tall building in London and pointing our iPhones at something for 24 hours, right? Like that wasn't going to cut it. Like this was a much, you know, bigger, riskier, more expensive piece. And I think that whilst, you know, some clients like did want to do stuff like that, they really did want to do stuff like that. Other clients, yeah, they definitely didn't. Like they definitely didn't. And, you know, it kind of makes sense to me in some ways. Like there were, you know, I remember I think I was having a conversation with Mark Johnston, who we used to work with at Distilled at one point. And he was like, you know, there is always like a lower budget option, or, you know, or not always, but there is often a lower budget option for most of these things. And I do think that, you know, it's appropriate that we consider the lower budget option, right? Where it makes sense.
Yes.
You know, I'm definitely not advocating for, you know, wasting money. But yeah, at the same time, I do think there's merit in, kind of investing in a select number of pieces, I guess, or even just one piece a year, like one thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and not every piece has to be like really high budget. I'm even thinking like If you wanted to use a reactive PR strategy, why not make a quick post on your website that they can link to? And you have a more likely chance of even getting more coverage, because I do think that you're right. Like, asset, like showing an asset like that is a stronger case for the journalist to cover it. And it's a lot more concrete to show a resource. So it doesn't have to be fancy, but something, right?
Yeah. I mean, and I actually, I was kind of thinking about this from, like, from that, I guess, like, from that angle. So in terms of, like, what, you know, like, what am I really recommending for, like, assetless PR strategies? And they came up with a little example. might be useful. So essentially, like, I started thinking about, you know, obviously there's some types of reactive, assetless digital PR activity where, like, where we don't need an asset, you know, for every single reactive piece. But in some instances, I think we might actually get more out of these reactives if we do deliver one asset. So here's my little example. Imagine that you have a client that sells engagement rings, right? Jewelry client. They're an online jeweler's. And so one of your ideas might be, like, we're going to do a reactive piece on the valuation of every new hot celeb engagement that everyone's talking about. Because this happens all the time, right? We don't necessarily know who's going to get engaged, but there will always be every year hot celeb engagements. And the media noise around them tends to die down pretty quick, right? So I don't think you need to do a piece for every single engagement. But instead, I would suggest, like, what if you thought about creating a piece which over time you just added to? So if you did that, by the end of the year, you'd have a list of the valuations of every major celebrity engagement ring that year, right? Now, you could use that to tell a bigger story at the end of the year if you wanted. Might or might not work. But I also think you're starting to create a genuinely useful resource for the journalists who write these stories. Data like this could be useful for them, like, genuinely, because it would enable them to add more context to the current celeb engagement story, right? They could maybe compare this ring valuation to another ring valuation, perhaps, particularly if these celebrities are kind of warring. That seems fun to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't love this. But, you know, I'm just thinking, like, it's the sort of thing which I could imagine being written about. And they could also, like, help them talk about things like trends in the gemstones which are chosen, the cuts of the stones, the settings, and things like that, too. And, like, in my head, how I imagine this working is, like, every time you launch a new reactive story about a celeb engagement, you send your reactive story to the journalist, and you also point them towards that resource that you keep updating.
Art.
Mm-hmm. Then let's imagine you optimize that page, right? Over time, that page, maybe it starts to rank. There's a chance that the journalists who are researching these types of stories might find your resource, even if you've not personally directed them to it. I also think, like, what you're kind of building the sort of, potentially starting to build the sort of relationship with the journalist where they're like, let's imagine it's me, it won't be me. But I like to think in my head, so perhaps one of these, even if it's just one of these journalists, is just going to be like, do you know what, next time there's a celeb engagement story, I'm just not going to do anything at all. I'm just going to message Hannah and go, like, what's the deets on this one? Can I get a quote from your valuation expert on this one? Right. Now, of course, this won't always work in every instance, right? So I'm not saying every reactive piece you do has to feed into a bigger, longer updatable thing. But I do think that a lot of this type of activity could actually be leveraged further if you were thinking about, like, okay, like, where does it make sense to create an asset, and where am I fine without one? Do you know what I mean? See ya.
It feeds into your idea of updatable post and having your own, like, cornerstone. I call it cornerstone, but, you know, like, the piece that is yours that you are known for. That's very brilliant.
It is. Lizard. I love that.
If there's any listeners out there, you're welcome. That was a great idea.
I know,
for,
right?
For a jewelry company. I would run with that right now.
Do it. Do it. Everyone do it.
I mean, I need the client first, but.
Yeah. No, everyone do it.
I'll make sure to pitch it to them.
Just casually share this episode with all of those different types of companies.
There you go.
You're welcome.
There you go. Nice.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. Cool. So do you have any advice for PRs who feel like, you know, when you get started at either a new company or at an agency, or maybe it's with a new client if you're freelance, do you have any advice for those who have that problem of hitting the ground running and trying to think of all the wins that they can get right away? And no, I'm not talking about myself.
But it could be helpful.
Yes, it could be helpful. What do you say to people like that? Because I know you also coach PRs too. Ways of thinking and ways of approaching new strategies.
Yeah, and I guess what I would, it's part of the reason why I am a fan of reactive or assetless PR. Like I don't ever want to come across like I don't like this stuff or I don't write this stuff. I think it's an incredibly useful tactic. And you know, absolutely engaging in reactive activity is particularly helpful for getting those, as you say, those early wins. And I think when you're kind of starting a new relationship with a client, or when you're new at an agency, for example, and therefore like you've maybe got a whole roster of clients that you want to impress, you want them to, you know, like you and trust you and know that you're good at your work. I think that, you know, reactive activity can be really beneficial to gain that trust quickly. I guess what I would then seek to do, if you can, is transition the conversation about like, hey, you know, this is the thing that we can do. And you know, this reactive stuff is effective. But have you thought about, is there something you would like to be known for? What might that look like? What proprietary expertise are available within the company that we could really, really leverage, or proprietary data? Kind of, do you know what I mean? Like thinking mm-hmm. about like,
oh yeah.
Even if, you know, budgets are challenging. So I'm not talking about trying to persuade a client entirely away from reactive activity towards just hero or just content-led activity, but instead talking to them about like, hey, if we did just one thing a year, can we talk about what might look like? Yeah. And I think this stuff is, I do think it's helpful to be able to go to people with an idea or with like a handful of options, if you can. Just not to try to sell them those options, but just to give them a clearer idea of what it is you're thinking. Because I do think that we all have a tendency to get caught up in the whole like linked coverage thing. Like, you know, every month we have a linked coverage target or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Like maybe it's not monthly, maybe it's quarterly, whatever. Maybe it's the length of an engagement. But we all have this thing where we're like, got to hit that linked coverage number. And I think that sometimes we kind of like, we don't give ourselves like the very best chance of hitting it because we're just like running too fast. You know, we're just like, oh, next thing, next thing, next thing, next thing, gotta hit that number. And I do think sometimes like it can be beneficial to kind of take a step back and go like, you know, what are we, you know, how could we work a bit smarter? Like, is there something that we could build or create which might enable us to work a bit smarter. And I guess that's really how I would encourage people to kind of start these conversations. And you know, I would also acknowledge that like this this isn't applicable to like every business or every client. Do you know what I mean? Like not every not every business needs to, well, not every business needs digital PR at all, right? One. It may or may not be like a useful tactic for every business. But even all the businesses that do engage in digital PR, they still might not need to build a moat, right? Like it just depends. Do you know what I mean? It depends on the size of the business, the scope of the business, like what their objectives are. So, you know, I'm not suggesting this is right for everyone, but I do think it's right, or it could be right, for a significant proportion of those who are already engaging in digital PR.
Cool. Yeah. I do have a question for you, Hannah. I actually earlier, Britt, when you're like, you're nodding a lot, I was thinking about a client that I've worked with for a long time, actually, since like 2018, like end of 2018 or something like that. And we very much, like on day one that I came on, they came to me with an idea of an annual study that we would put together. And it works great. And it's like something that we did become known for. But what we have found is our competitors have taken notice. And the last, I'd say, 2 years of us putting out the study, frustratingly, they have been putting them out earlier than us and trying to compete with coverage. And it's so icky. And I imagine that it's something that other listeners maybe deal with in their own industries. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you have advice. My thought was like, maybe we just start producing it earlier in the year and try to come up with ways to differentiate how ours is maybe better in some way. But it's also like, these things are easier said than done, right? So I'm just wondering if you have advice.
Yeah. So I guess like there's a couple of things to consider. I guess like the challenge is like they're doing it earlier, so you do it earlier, then they do it earlier still. And you, do you know what I mean? Like we're kind of another race to the bottom. Really? Yeah. But question: could you run it slightly differently? So could you run? So right now you have like an annual study. Is there a way you could split that annual study into 12 individual pieces and run one a month?
That would be cool.
That might be a thing that you could consider doing. And then obviously at the end of the 12-month cycle, you can still do, here's our big thinger. But what you're doing is like a more constant, you're a more constant resource. The other thing I would consider.
I love that.
The other thing I would consider doing is also, and I kind of recommend this to everyone who does an annual study, ask forgiveness, not permission, one, and try and shoehorn in like some kind of wild card question, which you can use almost to generate a kind of standalone story. So whatever the hot thing in inverted commas is in that niche. So I don't know which particular niche you're kind of working in, but kind of shoehorn in a question which is outside of the questions that you always ask, because and definitely don't replace a question that you always ask. But basically try and have something like in your back pocket that hopefully your competitors kind of won't have thought of, because they are following you, right? And obviously, like, we can never stop people from following us, but I do think like one of the ways that we can certainly try and get ahead of this stuff is like, you know, the power of an annual survey is that you ask the same questions and you can trace like how
historical data
and stuff have changed. But like, yeah, don't ignore like what's kind of either on the horizon or just coming up, and see if you can get agreement to do like a cheeky little wild card question. Or as I say, just include a wild card question and don't tell anyone and just go, oh, I'm sorry, I thought you saw that. I might have done that before. Been known to do stuff like that in surveys. They'll thank you when you get a load of coverage. They'll be fine when you get a load of coverage for it. But yeah, I would kind of encourage you to kind of think in those terms. The other thing which may or may not be possible, but certainly something which I think is like really worth noting about the Forbes rich list. And one of the things which I think is really fascinating about the Forbes rich list is essentially, obviously, they do every year, they do the rich list, and it's actually many rich lists, right? They have a whole load of different categories, but kind of quietly and with not a huge amount of fanfare, they launched the real-time billionaires list a few years ago. So essentially, a subset of the Forbes rich list is now real-time. That is so incredible as a driver of stories. So like just last week, The Independent wrote a story about, I'm just checks notes. The Independent ran a story with this headline, Musk may drop below Bezos in world's richest list after court rules he cannot keep his $56 billion Tesla payout. Now, this story references and links directly to the Forbes real-time billionaires list. So they're now not just a source for stories when they launch their lists each year. They're a source for stories all year round. Like, this is not unusual. Like, throughout the year, journalists are leaning on another publication's real-time rich list. So I guess, like, the other thing I would ask, and this might be really, really hard to do, what could you do that might, it won't be really real time, I imagine, but nudges closer towards real time, maybe.
Yeah. I think just off the top of my head, if you're listening and you're thinking, how do I make like a real time, if it's proprietary data, you could work with the if you have development resources, talk with them, because they would know how to do that, essentially. Yeah,
exactly. So yeah, and I do think that that's, you know, and like I say, it doesn't really have to be real time, right? It can just be updatable. So like I said, you can update it once a month or whatever. Like, it doesn't have, but you just call it real time if you want. No one's
love that. Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
Who's going to know? No one's going to
know. You can apologize later, you know?
Yeah. This is bad PR advice. Don't listen to this. I've started to get mercenary. Awful anarchist. Stop it. But yeah, do you know what I mean? Like, that's another thing I would try and consider doing. Because again, this will be, nothing is impossible for a competitor to replicate. I would acknowledge that. But we can make things harder for them.
I love that. That's great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Super helpful.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Hannah. Where can our listeners find you so they can follow along with all of these brilliant insights and find that article that you have published that goes into more detail on this?
Thanks so much for having me. You can find the article on my site. My site is wordarist.com. And I'm around a little bit on Twitter and a little bit on LinkedIn, probably not as much as I should be. Please do feel free to connect with me and chat to me on either of those networks, or just drop me an email. Honestly, I love email. People don't email me enough. I'm happy to be emailed. Drop me an email.
Okay.
What's your email?
Hannah@wordarist.com.
Lovely. All right. Brilliant. Cool. Thank you for listening to this episode of We Earn Media. Jacqueline and I have a bit of a favor to ask. If you find the podcast useful and have an extra minute or two to spare, we would be incredibly grateful if you could take just a moment to leave a rating. Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps others discover our show. Thank you so much, listeners, for being a part of our PR community, and we can't wait to hear what you think.